Hey everybody, thanks for letting me be here. This is a great opportunity to feel like I'm a part of AA, to feel like I belong. And for someone like me, feeling like I belong is a real nice feeling. I've never owned a suit in my life. I've never had a reason to. I really sort of hated the suit. And when I got the message that I was asked to come out here and talk, I got real mad. And I said, how dare you have a dress code? How dare you? And I went through a couple days of, what am I going to do? I'm going to go out there. And what I was going to do is come out here, guns blazing, telling you guys what I thought about that. So I went out and bought a suit. Because these days, you know what? I'm not looking for a fight. I'm really not. I'm not looking to bring disruption or disharmony to anything. I'd like to walk a little softer through my life. Whereas before, I certainly would have come guns blazing and y'all would have been really sort of put off by what I had to say about wearing a suit. But now I own a suit and I bet you there's going to be another reason to own it. I'm here to tell my story. Let me tell my story. My name is Finn. I am an alcoholic. Amen. Hey guys. Yeah. My sobriety date is March 1st, 2022. I have a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. I call him and he answers. I've got a sponsee and we just finished working third step. And, you know, that's been a very rewarding process so far. I was born 1979, Finian Key McGurk. My dad was a DC firefighter. I was born in Alexandria, Virginia, just south of DC. My mom is an interesting lady. She's highly educated, graduated from Vassar, lived all over the world. She was working at the Smithsonian as a textile restorer. And I guess when she met my dad, she sort of gave up all that and started to be a stay-at-home mom. So my dad was a firefighter, my mom's a stay-at-home mom. And I was trouble from the very get-go. I was a trouble baby, as the stories are told. And I can remember being a young kid and it being a lot of trouble. I struggled with being a young kid. But what I struggled with was there was a clear message that I was the problem. You know, at school, there was that message. At home, there was that message. Now, my folks are very loving and good people. I'm not here to disparage them. I'm not here to talk ill about them. They did the best they could with what they had at the time. But there was problems. There just was. I was part of the problem. I brought a lot of disruption to the family. By the time I was 8, there was 5 of us. I got an older sister, a younger sister, and 2 little brothers. And we were raised Catholic with an Irish slant to it, whatever that may mean. But I remember there was a push to recognize the Irish heritage as far as Catholicism was concerned. I was getting in trouble in elementary school. I was diagnosed with ADHD and some other learning disabilities. I was put on medications. They were sort of experimenting with medications with me. And this was in the 80s, and you know, things weren't sorted out as much as they are now. So it was pretty tough. I remember some of the medications really threw me for a loop, and I hated it. What I hated about the medication was it stopped me feeling like I was myself. You know, it took away like this fun feeling I had. And it made me sit down and shut up, but I hated it. But there was a clear message that we don't like how you act. Here, take this, and we will. And, you know, you can take that for what you want, but it's kind of where I first learned to alter the way I feel based on taking something, you know. Junior high school comes around, and that's when the train started falling off the tracks for sure. I got in all kinds of trouble, fighting, skipping school. I started smoking weed, started drinking. My first drink was somewhere around 12 or 13. I don't really remember the age, but I remember the experience clearly. I had just bought from the thrift store a Led Zeppelin II album record, and I had a little, just to put it in perspective, I had a Fisher Price record player, the kind with the handle on the top. And I stole some beers out of the fridge, and I went in my room, and I put that record on, and I got drunk. And man, the feeling of arrival, or this was me, or this is what it was, just palpable. I had found what I was about to live my life for. And then I proceeded to live my life for alcohol, for sure. But junior high school was nothing but trouble. I got kicked off the bus to school, fighting, suspended, the whole thing. But by the time high school came around, I was getting tired of getting in trouble because it really did get in the way of what I wanted to do, which was drink. Excuse me. 14, I had a fake ID. It worked. And it worked at 7-Eleven and some other places. And from the time I was 14 to 18, I could buy my own alcohol. I could buy, and 40s were big back then. So it was malt liquor. And I did. I bought it. If you had a party, you called me and I got your alcohol for the party. And during that time, I would also drink by myself. I would get alcohol and I would go off high by myself and drink it. I'd hide in my room and drink it. I remember there was once I was doing homework, getting drunk in my room, pretending to do homework. But it just struck me as weird. It strikes me as weird now. That is not okay behavior. That's there's a real problem there. But I was blind to it. I was on this thing where I was Mr. Party Guy, Mr. Punk Rock. I didn't care about your rules. I didn't care about your structure. I was going to break them, and I was going to show you why I was going to break them. And I did. Let's see. High school was, school wasn't a big thing for me. I struggled with school real, real hard. About 10th grade, I was fixing to drop out. And, that was sort of unacceptable. The message I was getting from home was that's not a thing you do. They tried to take me to Catholic school, but the Catholic school wouldn't take me because my record and my grades were too bad. And that's kind of where my parents were just like, we got other kids to take care of. You're going to have to sort some of this out yourself. And they kind of, the guidance sort of loosened up at that point because there really was other kids in the house and I was disrupting. I was taken away from my brothers and sisters and their chance of getting parented. I was dominating the attention through bad behavior and acting out. Instead of dropping out, I found out that I could go. There was a vocational program at a neighboring high school, and there was an HVAC program there. So for the rest of high school, most of what I did was a vocational HVAC program. And that was great because it was applied, it was hands-on. I could understand all sorts of high concepts about things, but you had to show me why. You had to give me a reason to put my hands on it. And that's how I learned. I couldn't really learn from a book. And that's kind of how AA is for me. I can't really learn just from reading that book. I got to get out there and do it. Let's see. So HVAC program led me to getting involved in a high school program called VICA, the Vocational Industrial Clubs of America. And I got involved in, I taught myself how to do sheet metal fabrication and I competed in it, which was, you take a flat piece of metal and you bend it, break it, cut it to the specifications of the competition, and then they judge it on how well you did. They measure it and whatnot. I won districts, regions, states, and then they sent me to nationals, which was a week in Kansas City. This was my senior year in high school. So I went down there. I was fired up. I was good at this. I taught myself how to do this. It was, building ductwork fittings. And the night before, first off, Kansas City, I think it was Missouri, that city's split in half. I think we were on the Missouri side. I found out you could buy liquor at a gas station. And I had my fake ID. And so I bought liquor at that gas station. And the night before my competition, I got real drunk, stayed up all night drinking. And the morning, it was like a 7:30 start time. And I showed up too drunk, hungover, whatever it was, to compete. It was a squared around fitting. I had made the same fitting to win states. I knew how to do it, but that morning my brain was just jello. I couldn't do it. Couldn't focus, couldn't do it. And I felt like a big ass. Really, I did. I let myself down. I let the other people down, but really, I let myself down. And I'm telling that story because that was the first time that I had re worked really hard, built up this thing, and then just sort of pissed it away. What happened? Alcoholism. That's what happened. I didn't have any power against that impulse, that urge to drink. And the other folks I was drinking with that night, they weren't going at it like I was. I was going at it with, I guess, nerves of competing, whatever. I was trying to solve a problem. And I didn't. I created more problems. And that sort of theme went throughout my drinking career, if you will. I got arrested about 18, 19, coming back from DC. I used to go there to buy weed, drugs off the corner. You just go, and these dudes are on the corner. And I got arrested coming back. I was rolling a joint right across from Reagan National Airport on the George Washington Parkway. There was a little pull-off parking spot. I'm rolling the joint, throw a seat out the window, and there's a police guy right there. Lights me up, takes me in, processes me, and that's federal property. So now I've got a federal charge of possession, and I'm on the books. I'm on government paper. They put me on federal probation, and on that probation, I got a drunk in public at some party. I was wasted, running my mouth, something. Cops came. I actually gave them my fake ID. And they said, "Who is this?" I said, And they said, "Come with me." I got the drunk in public, spent a night in jail. Oddly enough, that was my only time in jail, that night in the drunk tank. I tried, but I never got put in jail again for that, for anything. Just like I tried to get a DUI, but I never did. I never did. But anyway, that drunk in public was the start of AA for me because they put me on ASAP and other crap, but they made me go to AA meetings. So I went to a club in Northern Virginia. There's some clubs. And I went to a club, I looked it up and I went. And I don't remember what was said in that first meeting I went to, but it rocked me. It hit me, at my core, because it was then that I knew I had a problem. I knew whatever was said in that meeting hit home. I knew then that I alcoholism, whatever they were calling it, that's what I had. I just sort of knew. I denied it. I pushed it away and I kept doing what I was doing. But somewhere around 22, well, before that, I got a job down on the corner at Charlottesville. A buddy of mine bought the Virginia and he wanted me to come help his brother run it. So about 21, I go down there and I'm the assistant manager of the Virginia. I was in charge of ordering the liquor. I was in charge of bartending, and it was a big problem. A big problem. I lived on the corner on Elliewood, and it was just a year-long party. I could only last a year for sure. That's why I started doing other drugs like cocaine and stuff, but it was always drinking. It was starting with drinking, it was drinking in the middle, and it was drinking at the end. Always for me. Other things got mixed in there, but it was always drinking. So that little stint was a problem, and I crashed and burned, and I had to go back to Northern Virginia. And that's where I first went to AA on my own. And I went back to that club what I had first gone to. And, I was Mr. Super AA. I was 22 years old. I was on fire, going to th three meetings a day. I worked the steps. I had a sponsor. I was into it. And about nine months, somewhere around there, I had a girlfriend. We were going to a concert for no reason at all. no reason at all, I bought a bottle of Southern Comfort and I drank it. There wasn't anything really going on or wrong. It's just alcoholism. I had the impulse and I was powerless against it. So I threw away all that work I had done, all that good feeling I had. I just threw it away in one night. And from there, I started to think I was too unique for AA. I had tried it and it didn't work. Look, I had this evidence. I was too young, In that stint, people of AA at 22, people had told me, "Oh, you're probably too young." Some dude actually said to me that he threw up more whiskey than I ever drank. He did. And I was like, "Well, let's see about that." And it was kind of like a challenge, I didn't have enough experience. So I went out and I was determined to go get experience. And I thought I was too unique, that this wasn't for me. 20s were rough. I don't remember a whole lot, but somewhere around 25, I went to culinary school. I moved to Pittsburgh, and there was a classic French culinary school in downtown Pittsburgh. And I went into the baking program, the pastry arts program. I just had this sort of calling, I suppose you could say, that I needed to bake bread. It was just a calling. I don't know where it came from, but it just came. And so I went out about doing that. I got a job at a bakery. I went to culinary school. I got a degree as a pastry chef. That's my only formal education is a French pastry chef. It still strikes me as weird. But I did, and I got a degree, and I put myself through school by working at night at some of the local bakeries there. I would work at night, I'd get off, and I'd go to school till about noon, and then I'd make it work. And I was determined to not repeat some of these things I'd done in the past of building it up and pissing it away. And I finished, barely, but I finished. And from there, it was at culinary school I met my first wife, and there was red flags everywhere. There was, we were waving red flags at each other. And she had the idea that we should move to Columbus, Ohio to be closer to our family. So I had no reason not to. Let's go. Moved to Columbus. I got a job at a bakery in Columbus, Stan Evans Baker, who's the son of Bob Evans. This was the sausage guy. This was after they had sold the rights and whatever. But he was an interesting dude. He was probably an alcoholic himself. And it was at that bakery, it was in Columbus, that some of my darkest and most depressing and isolated drinking was done. My wife at the time got pregnant right after we were married, right after my son was born. He was about one and a half, two. We learned that she was manic bipolar. Her mom was. But she had a complete psychotic break, just went nuts, for lack of a better way of putting it. She took my son and went up to Fremont area, northern Ohio, and nobody could find her. Finally, she turned up. My son's at her sister's house, and they pick her up and take her to the hospital. She beats up some nurses and whatever. And I'm driving from Columbus to there, drinking the whole way. I show up at the emergency room to try and rescue her, drunk. The police were in the emergency room, and they knew I was drunk. But I think the guy took pity on me. He went like this, like cops do when they're about to get you. They put their hand on their the handcuffs, and then he looked at me and he gave me this look. And I probably will never forget it. He gave me this look of like pity. It's the best I can say. And he said, "You better get out of here." So I just left. I went to my car and I waited for her to get discharged. She got taken to a mental institution in Toledo. I took my son back to Columbus, and my mom came to help out from Charlottesville area. And it was tough, dire times. I was a raging alcoholic at that point, drinking the blackouts. I was a blackout drinker by the time I was 15 or 16, But during that time, I was a blackout all the time. You know, I would drink and that was it. I wouldn't really go out. I was really terrified of DUIs and people and whatnot. So I would spend all my time in the basement drinking. I would go to work, and it was around that time I started drinking in the morning. They had shut my water off because I didn't pay the bill. It was a couple of days before Christmas, and my wife and my son went up to her family's because we didn't have any water, and I stayed because I had to work. And it was complete demoralization. I couldn't see a way out. I couldn't think of a way out. I was stuck and lonely and miserable. And I kept drinking more and more. At that point, it was still providing some relief, the alcohol was. Vodka was pretty much what I drank because I was drinking so much that, you know, I needed something without anything else in it. I needed just alcohol. So it was around that time in Columbus. I actually tried to get sober in Columbus, Ohio. I didn't really, but I tried. And we decided things weren't working there. So we moved back to Northern Virginia, moved in with my brother. And the marriage was just a mess. It was falling apart. She was mentally ill, struggling with that. I was mentally ill, struggling with my alcoholism. But I was so selfish back then that I looked at her mental illness as a burden, my burden. How dare she do this to me? You know, she's ruining my life. And I feel real not great about that now. You know, I could have been a lot more helpful and supportive of her, but I wasn't. I was selfish and I was self-centered. And her mental illness took away from my serenity, my happiness, and I was angry. We get a divorce. And it was around that time I took a job at a bakery in Charlottesville. I was experiencing over and over like bottoms, what I thought was a bottom, and then I'd figure out another shittier bottom, a worse bottom. It was like it kept getting just a little bit worse. And finally, I just couldn't do it anymore. My dad found the job on Craigslist in Charlottesville, and he sent the little note to me. And I called the dude, and I got an interview. I drove from Northern Virginia to Charlottesville drinking. I showed up at the interview drunk, and the guy in the interview said, "You kind of smell like alcohol. What's up with that?" And I, you know, played it off. Oh, I was celebrating last night, late last night. It's not a problem. But I got the job somehow. I had a pretty strong baking resume, and when you're looking for a baker, it's kind of hard to find a head baker. At any rate, I got the job, and I started the job. And I was at the time I was going through a separation, and I didn't know what was going to happen, divorce or whatnot. I started a job, I was drinking. We decide we're gonna get a divorce. I realized that she was in a manic episode the entire time. So I had to file for emergency custody on my son. And I got it. And it was right then that I started to realize I needed to get sober because I couldn't leave my son to this situation. Now, my first wife is a good person, but she's not really capable of being a mom. She just isn't, and that's what it is. So I fought to get sober for my son, so that, you know, I could get custody. And I went through the, it was like a 2-year custody battle. The divorce was easy, but it was the custody that was the problem. I went through guardian ad litem home visits, CPS home visits, all this legal crap. Not drinking, clean and sober. And I stood up in court and I got custody of my son. He was 8. And then I was like scared to death because now it was just me and my son. What the hell do I do now? It was heavy duty stuff. I was working at that bakery in Charlottesville. I was struggling to stay sober. I was, but I was struggling. I was working nights. I would get off. I would get my son to school. We lived in a basement of a house that me and my sister, we split the renting a house. She took the upstairs, we took the downstairs. It was not a basement apartment. It was just a basement. So I was cooking on a hot plate and a microwave, washing dishes in the bathroom sink. And, CPS and guardian ad litem, they were coming and they were doing home visits at this situation. But what they saw was me being honest, me honestly trying to be sober and stay sober. And, it's looking back, I don't know how I did it. I really don't. I think it was because I abandoned myself to the program. I had a sponsor. I was working the steps with him. My home group was the Peace and Recovery at Peace Lutheran, the noon meeting, and I would go as much as I can, but I was there often. I'd get off and I would like sleep in my car in the parking lot till noon, and then go to the meeting. But my son, is 8, 9. I'm trying to be a single father, and it was very difficult. It was around that time that I met my second wife, and she is a good person. But it was a situation where, again, we weren't being honest with ourselves. She might be an alcoholic. I don't know. It's not for me to say. But we start dating, and the alcoholism started to kick in. I didn't drink, but this dry drunk thing, it's a real deal. I quit the job at the bakery because I saw the writing on the wall. The business was going out. It's not there anymore. It was going out of business. So I took, she was working at this interesting place called Innisfree Village. And I thought it was pretty cool. So I wanted to be a part of it. It's a life sharing community for adults with disabilities. We all live and work there together. It's not hippie or religious or anything. It just is. But I'm the groundskeeper out there now. I've been there about 6 years. But it was in going out there that I stopped going to AA. This was 6 years ago, 7 years ago. I just stopped. I had this girl, this woman, she was took the place of what AA was doing. And I put too much dependence and emphasis on a person. And ultimately that let me down. I still didn't drink, and it's interesting to me how unmanageable my life was, even without any alcohol. The sobriety date that I give is really more of an acceptance date. I haven't had a drink in 8 years, but that sobriety date is when I came back into AA, after being out there dry drunk and just running amok. My second marriage took the brunt of that dry drunk. I was restless, I was irritable, I was discontent, and I took it out on the marriage. Not necessarily her, but the marriage. And she has her own issues, her own host of problems, and it just didn't work. That divorce will be finalized next month. And I'm going through that divorce with a lot more compassion and understanding for the situation than I did the first one. Especially since we both live and work at the same place. We see each other every day, and it kind of it has accelerated the getting over it process, because yeah, it's kind of abnormal. Usually you split, you don't see anybody each other again, but now we see each other every day and things are okay. So that's what it was like. That's what kind of drove me back into the rooms was the restless, irritable, and discontent. It was the pitiful demoralization that I experienced without ever drinking. That's alcoholism. It's the alcohol was a solution, but towards the end of my drinking, the alcohol was adding to the problem. It stopped relieving anything. It was adding anxiety. It was adding fear. it wasn't taking anything away except for my self-respect, my dignity, and so I come back in and I was angry. I was angry at AA. I came back in, I tried to say I had 5 years. Oh, I've got 5 years. I didn't have any serenity. I didn't have any recovery. And I came back in and I was angry. I would share about people smiling. I feel like punching them in the face and all this stuff because I just couldn't deal with other people being happy because I wasn't. So this past 2 years, and I've skipped over quite a bit of what it was like because I want to talk more about what it is like now, because man, it is so much different. It's so much better now. And really what it took was accepting that this program could work and does work, but I got to let it. I got to do the things that are required that I need to, but I got to let it happen. And before, previous attempts, I wasn't fully letting it. I wasn't fully accepting that second half of step one, that my life was unmanageable, was the part that I didn't take. Sure, I was an alcoholic. I could admit that all day long, but that my life wasn't was unmanageable. Nah, I got this. You can't tell me anything, really. It was that rebellious streak that, I hear a lot about in AA. These days are better in that regard, but they're also better in that my focus now is on being humble, whatever that may mean for the day, and being useful, selfless action towards other people. This is where I get the most relief from my alcoholism is being helpful, is coming and being a part of AA, feeling like I belong in AA, yes, but also just people in general, just human beings. Where can I be of service? Where can I do God's will? I get a little skeptical when people start telling me what God's will is, but when I'm sitting quietly with myself meditating, and I do that, I can do that now, not for very long, but I can sit quietly. What comes is the thing that strikes me as God's will or the universe's will, whatever works for you, is what isn't harmful to people and what is helpful. And that very simple thing right there is what sort of settles. There's no bright lights for me. There's no kapow, I'm struck a certain way. It just kind of settles. It just kind of surfaces of what it is I should do. And some days that doesn't come about until later in the day. I struggle all day long until later in the night when I go, oh, I missed all this stuff in the day. Okay, now I get it. I'll try and do better tomorrow. I go to a bunch of meetings. I really am into Zoom. I'm on Zoom, the early bird meeting every day, or every day I can, which is almost every day. I read as much literature as I can. I be around as many AA people as I can because that's me. Those are my people. That's me being part of the herd, like Bill talks about in the book, the herd mentality. It's where I can get outside of myself. It's where I can show care and compassion for others. Now, this person here telling you care and compassion for others, I didn't care most of my life. It was what can I get from you at the beginning? And then it was push everything away. I was extremely isolated as an alcoholic. So now this attempt, we'll call it an attempt because I'm not dead yet. I'm interested in not any of that. I'm not interested in being isolated. I'm interested in being around people. There's a version of me not too long ago that would have not come out here. No way. It would have been terrifying. This is a terrifying experience, believe me. but I'm able to sort of do it. And it's really not any sort of power that I got going on necessarily. It's a power that I'm drawing from you guys because, like I said, this is the herd mentality. This is where I belong. There's a guy I know who says that. He doesn't say, "This is so and so, I'm an alcoholic." He says, "I'm so and so, I really do belong here." Man, I love hearing that whenever he says that because it reminds me. It's like that little ding that they do when you meditate, like the dong that brings you back to what you're focusing on. I really do belong here. Not because I drank a lot, not because some dude threw up more whiskey than I ever drank, but because I'm an alcoholic. I've conceded to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic and that I can never drink safely again. Well, I didn't ever really drink safely to begin with, but what that means to me now is safely for other people. I never got a DUI, but I sure drove drunk. And towards the end, I drove drunk with my son in the car. That is a terrifying thought. That one has woken me up at night. How did I do that? How insane was I? I've heard people say, this is my favorite step. This one's my favorite step. I think step two is my favorite step because I've come to believe in a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Well, first I had to realize I'm insane, and I fought that for a long time. My first wife was insane, not me. But looking back, I can see how similar we were. She had a psychotic break. I was in the middle of a psychotic break. My second wife, I don't know what her deal is. It's not for me to take her inventory, but I'm able to have compassion for her. This is the promise is coming true. Me standing here right now is the fear of people has left me, kind of. We'll be amazed before we're halfway through the steps. I don't know. I sometimes I get bogged down in them. Like the steps. I work a third step maybe half a dozen times a day, because I need to. I think I've given my will over and I take it back, or I think I know what the path is and then I lose it and I have to find it again. And this reoccurs throughout my days. So I have to carry the steps with me as, I've heard people say, as like a tool bag or a tool set, but I have to carry them with me every day throughout my day to make it through the day. Because at any real moment, I can cause harm. I can hurt somebody's feelings or do something to disrupt the situation, which I really have no desire to. The desire to drinking has left me for sure. Drinking stuff, parties, whatnot, I really don't have any interest in. I will go to things with the steps, with my AA tools, and I can do it. But I always have a contingency plan. I always have a way out. I have an escape plan. And I'm really just not that interested in drinking stuff. And that obsession, that feeling of okay, is, I mean, yeah, you don't want to miss this. I don't want to miss this. I don't want to piss this away. And I've got a certain measure, a certain maybe healthy fear that I could. Because this idea that the best reason for me to drink is no reason at all, and I've proven that, it kind of keeps me humble, it keeps me honest. I could get the impulse to drink, and bam, I'm drunk. So I have to put a bunch of roadblocks in the way. I wake up every day, I'm an alcoholic. I wake up tomorrow, I'm an alcoholic. What am I going to do about it? Well, the first thing I have to do is, for me, what I find works is connect with AA, connect with what is saving me, connect with what is giving me a set of principles to live by. And I do have a set of principles to live by now. And I try and, well, I guess in trying, I do it. There really isn't much trying. I attempt, I face that direction of applying these principles throughout my day. I do a 10th step when I need to. I say the third and the seventh step prayer most mornings. I'd like to say every morning, but that's probably not true. And what I'm doing when I'm doing that is first I'm trusting my higher power, third step. And the seventh step, I'm trying to give over my character defects, but not all of them. I'm no saint. What I'm saying when I do the seventh step prayer is take away these difficulties, these character defects that stand in the way of my usefulness. So, what character defect might be in the way of me being useful to somebody? Remove that. Not all of them, not all of them all at once, or every day. That's too much for me to understand, too much for me to handle. Just the ones that are in my way. And I've heard people say it a real cool way for me to understand is my character defects are under new management. I'm not really interested in them anymore. My higher power, you deal with it. And I really like phrasing it or framing it that way. It helps me get through the day. And that right there is keeping it in simple in one day. That also really helps me because before, like everybody does, you bite off these big chunks. What am I going to do with all these problems 6 months from now, 10 years from now? And then going over things in the past, none of that helps. None of that helps me maintain serenity. None of that helps me stay recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, which I am. I was hopeless. Maybe not so much in the body, but certainly in the mind. And I have recovered. By surrender is not the best word for me. Surrender, that's a tough one. But I do accept that I have a disease, that I was insane, and that I can be there again easily, just an impulse. So these days I come and I tell my story in front of people that I've never met, and I feel kind of at home. I feel kind of, you guys are really nice people. I feel very welcome. And yeah, that is the arrival. That Led Zeppelin II record and the Fisher-Price record player, that was fleeting. That was escaping. This here is arriving at maybe becoming who I really am by shedding things, not by adding stuff. AA is helping me take away some of the baggage, take away some of the layers that I had put on to maybe survive. Maybe some of these things help me survive through the years. Okay, they're no longer relevant. They're no longer pertinent. So I don't need them anymore. But me, my ego, my little conscious existence, this human situation I got going on here holds on to them real tight. The trust issues that I have and the problems I have with rebellion. I want to hold on to that because I think that's me, but it might not be. And I have to remain open-minded enough to let things I hear in AA, people I meet in AA, help me take them off. Because I really can't do it by myself. I've tried. I have tried over and over to do it by myself. I felt I'm too unique for AA, but I'm not. I'm just like everybody else. And that is actually a very comforting feeling that there is a solution, and that solution does work for me. I've heard people say that AA is not for people that need it or want it. It's for people that do it. Well, this is us doing. This is me doing it, you guys doing it, and we're doing it. And that is a very comforting and nice feeling to somebody that didn't have a whole lot of comforting and nice feelings and certainly couldn't give them for myself. Seems like all the stuff I did created anger and resentment and distrust in me and other people. So let's see. I live and I work at a place and I'm the groundskeeper, but we get reviewed from time to time. And I recently just got reviewed on my job performance, but also when you live there, they're kind of reviewing on what kind of person you are, really. And I have not acted very well in the past, certainly not in a marriage. But this review, I was nervous about it. And the overwhelming word that was used in this review was reliable. Finn is reliable. What? No one's ever called me reliable before. But I take a little bit, as much pride as I'm allowed to or can take, in the fact that I do show up. I can show up for people that need me to, putting myself second or third in favor of helping someone else. So things that I thought I was, things that I thought made me cool before, I'm not that interested in anymore. And I don't know about love. I was in a meeting this morning. We talked about love. And I'm not sure about it, but I really do like AA. I really do like the people I meet in AA. And I've heard people say that I fell in love with AA. I'm not sure about that. I don't know. Maybe I will. I'm leaving it open. But I really like AA because it works for me. And let's see, what else can I gush about AA? I think that might be it. I really do appreciate this opportunity, guys. It has helped me immensely. So thank you.